Our next speaker is Nguyen. He's the chair of the Department of Surgery and professor of surgery at UC Irvine. He's going to be talking about the treatment of peptic ulcer disease in the bariatric patient.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation. So I'm going to be talking with you about treatment of peptic ulceration in a subset of patient population of the bariatric surgery patient. I am a speaker for Olympus. So marginal ulceration, that's how it's called in the bariatric population, is defined as an ulcer within the margin of the anastomosis, commonly seen on the jejunal sides of the anastomosis. The incidence range is listed there, but it's more on the high side here rather than on the lower side. It's relatively common, particularly for a certain operation. These are the three most common operation. The band nowadays is obsolete. However, we have the gastric bypass and the sleeve gastrectomy. In 2013, the sleeve gastrectomy overtook that of the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. So the sleeve now is the most common bariatric operation, to follow by the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. So which of these procedures would you think has the highest rate of peptic ulceration? Is it the sleeve or is it the gastric bypass? It is the gastric bypass. Rarely do we see ulceration in the sleeve gastrectomy. And these are the etiology of marginal ulceration here. With conventional peptic ulcer disease, as you can see here, high acidity and H. pylori are the most common factor associated with that. But for marginal ulceration, it's a little different. Ischemia and intake of NSAID are the two most important culprit in this patient population. Ischemia, a lot of our patients are smoker, so we have to counsel the patient to stop smoking. And there is some relationship to construction of the Roux-en-Y that can lead to ischemia. Might it be ischemia of the Roux limb, or might it be the relative ischemia of the gastric pouch leading to marginal ulceration? And I'm just going to show you some objective findings related to that. But other etiology includes gastrogastric fistula, high acid environment, presence of H. pylori, and also the presence of foreign body. So when you construct the Roux-en-Y, certainly the foreign body, the suture material, can be present in the ulcer that can lead to continuation of the marginal ulceration. So with my training, a lot of what has stated is that when you create a Roux-en-Y construction, you can actually have relative ischemia of the Roux limb. This is actually an image of perfusion based on ICG. So we use ICG, we inject it immediately, you can see the perfusion. So this is what we call the green scale, and the green shows perfusion. So everything you see green is very well perfused. So as you can see here, here's the anastomosis is here. The jejunum is very well perfused. However, there is relatively lack of perfusion at this cross bridge between the staple line of the gastric pouch and the staple line of the anastomosis. And so you can see here. So that is the area of relative ischemia that are prone to possible ulceration down the line. And this is actually observed quite frequently after a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, particularly the use of a staple anastomosis. So signs, symptom of marginal ulceration listed here, epigastric abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, food intolerance, chronic anemia, and hematemesis. And on upper endoscopy, which is the diagnostic test of choice, you can see here, here's the gastric pouch, and this is the jejunal, and you can see a relatively large crater at the level of the gastrojejunal anastomosis. And another test that should be done is really the upper GI study, which looked for the presence of a gastrogastric fistula. So the initial treatment includes a discontinue all NSAID, make sure there's no gastrogastric fistula, counsel the patient to stop smoking, place the patient on double PPI and carafate, make sure the patient does not have H. pylori, and also removal of the foreign body as seen here. You can see here that multiple suture within the ulcer of the anastomosis, and this is managed by a double channel endoscope and using a scissor and a grasper to actually cut the suture out. So what are the indications from surgical intervention? It's listed here, chronic pain from non-healing ulceration, hemorrhage, including hematemesis and chronic GI bleeding, and also perforation. What I can say about the surgical management is that you do not need to be a bariatric surgeon to manage these complications. These are just general surgical complication, and you should be equipped to handle these type of complication. But somehow there is a lot of paucity of general surgeons feel comfortable doing this. At our area in Orange County, a lot of the general surgeons will refer these type of cases to a center that does bariatric surgery, but we do not believe that is necessary. So if I need to revise a marginal ulcer for chronic non-healing, this is the procedure of choice here. So we'll go identify the area of the ulceration. We'll go ahead and resect that. And if it was a retrocolic, we'll convert it to an anticolic. So we'll take it out and actually convert that to an anticolic technique. And this can all be done laparoscopically. This particular patient referred to our center for massive hematemesis. The patient received 6 units in an outside institution. When we scoped the patient, significant amount of clots, it was within the gastric pouch. We couldn't even see anything. So the first thing you do is essentially open up and decompress the gastric pouch, get all the blood out so you can see the area of the marginal ulceration. And you can see here we can get quite a bit of, we stick our laparoscopic suction device directly into the pouch and just get all the blood out so you can actually see. And once you decompress the blood clots, you should be able to visualize the area of the ulceration and the area of the bleeding, and then you will try to control it. And you can see here, tons of clots will just come out after decompression, and then we'll just close that. And then this, at this time, you can actually evaluate the gastric pouch, determine the area of the ulceration. In this particular case, it was a posterior ulcer at the level of the gastrojejunal anastomosis. And it was a very deep ulcer, so we elected to essentially revise and resect this area. And as you can see here, we're transecting the pouch and create and resect that whole entire Roux and Y complex and recreate using a circular stapler technique. You can do a linear stapler technique or a hand sewn, but in this particular case, we did a circular, and we used a transoral placement of the anvil, so the anvil is actually placed transorally. You can see here, here's the NG tube with the anvil in place, and we'll go ahead and pull it out, and we position the anvil at that place. There you go. So another complication frequently seen in the emergency room is free air. And this is in a patient with a Roux and Y gastric bypass. And you can see here the free air under the left hemi diaphragm is very easily seen. And you can see here, this is a CT scan demonstrated the actual site of the perforation and the free air. You know, more commonly, the reason for operation is also clean out of the abdomen. Here is a significant amount of free infected peritoneal fluid that needs to be removed. And I'm going to show you the video. This is actually a picture demonstrating the actual perforation site. And the way we can identify the perforation site is put the endoscope at the time of surgery, and you can see it lights up and it tells you exactly where the site is. And then the treatment is what we discussed about. Here's a diagram demonstrating placement of the suture, but you don't tie it, creating a tongue of omentum here. And then once we have that, and these can all be done laparoscopically, there's really no need to open these type of patient anymore. And you can see here, we can actually close them relatively directly onto the perforation site. And the endpoint would look like this, just tie down the three suture with the omental patch in there. So this is the reason why you should take the patient operating room. You can see here a lot of contamination. Take a look at over the liver. We have to suction all this out. You have to go down the pelvis to get all these fluid out. Because if you don't, these are going to be multiple abscesses that you're going to need to drain by IR. So the easiest way to drain all that is just in the operating room and just do all the suction. A lot of time you have this fibrinous debris that's attached to the area of the perforation. Do not mind moving that because you're going to have to uncover to actually see it. And I also use the endoscope to actually visualize the air. And you can see here, here's the perforation site. And you can see that immediately once upon placement of the endoscope. So we always have the endoscope in the room with us when we perform these type of GI procedure. And you can see it's right there. It's clearly seen. So go ahead and clean the edges off. So that's the first thing. Essentially, here's some momentum that's stuck to it. So we'll just clean the area up. And then we'll place our suture. And we'll just place it independently without tying. So it depends on the size of the perforation. For large perforation, we'll put like three suture. For a medium size like this one, we'll just place two suture. And then once we do that laparoscopically here, you actually just leave it hanging through the port without tying. So right now, the suture here actually exiting one of our trocar. And then we'll place another one, which will exit another trocar. And then this is where we create a tongue. We just go ahead and grab and just make a tongue of omentum. And the pedicle is still base down there, so it's still good blood supply. And then you route it through. And then use one of your grasper to actually control and have the omentum sit exactly where you want it to sit, and then you go ahead and notch it down. So essentially, that completes the omental patch. And then we'll again introduce the endoscope again to make sure there is no leaks. So this is one way to get your resident good at endoscopy, is that we use the endoscope for every operation that we do, for every GI tract operation. So they'll put it back in there. We submerge this underwater and check. There you go. You can see the endoscope just slide down and insufflate, and you can check for any air leaks. Once secure, we'll place a drain to the area of the infected purulent material and leave it in there for several days. A lot of my information came from this ASMBS textbook of bariatric surgery, so certainly you can use that as a reference. So in conclusion, marginal ulceration should be considered in patient presenting with abdominal pain after gastric bypass. The diagnosis should be confirmed by endoscopy. You do need to rule out the presence of gastrogastric fistula. Institute medical management, including removal of the foreign body, use PPI, stop smoking, and avoid NSAID. And if it does not heal, a laparoscopic revision should be entertained for patient, despite that does not have ulcer healing despite maximal medical management. And certainly laparoscopy is the procedure of choice in management of perforated marginal ulcer. With that, thank you very much.
Great series of talks. We have time for questions. I'm going to, while people are coming to the podium or to the speakers, I'm going to go ahead and ask the first question. I'd like to ask the panelists about pre-pyloric versus post-pyloric ulcers. It has been said that they're all peptic. How do you define that? How do you make sure you're really talking about a peptic ulceration if it's just before or just after the pylorus?
So I think very clearly the post-pyloric or duodenal ulcers, and I think the generally accepted definition of a pre-pyloric ulcer is within 3 centimeters of the pyloric channel.
You treat them the same?
I do. I have rarely seen one as far away as 3 centimeters. So I think those are acid related.
Other comments from the panel?
I agree.
First question, please.
Yeah, you mentioned doing, for a perforated gastric ulcer, a wedge resection. I wanted to ask exactly how far are your margins, and what do you do in the situation where it's difficult, say, by the GE junction? And then secondly, if you have to do an antrectomy, I find it hard to find what the landmarks are to do that externally during an operation in which an antrectomy is required.
So the incidence of perforation of the cardia ulcers is fortunately very rare. And there are two ways of attacking that. They're most commonly on the lesser curvature. So you're going to devascularize part of the upper stomach to get to it. And so there have been two approaches in this surgically, and that is, one is just expose that ulcer and wedge it out and add an antrectomy. I think that you alluded to that as the Poche operation. That's a lot of operating. But then there's also been a description of a tailored gastrectomy, where you do an antrectomy and resect in block all the way up to the EG junction. And you have to be very careful you don't narrow the EG junction. And I don't know how you would, maybe you can staple that, but I think you'd have a high risk of narrowing the EG junction. So a tailored antrectomy, including all the lesser curve. The landmarks can be challenging, but remember, probably 80% of perforated gastric ulcers are going to occur at the incisura. So that's almost a landmark then of itself. Where is the perforation? It's probably at the incisura. And so if I've got a patient with a perforated ulcer that, and I decide I want to do an antrectomy with it, I'll just tailor the extent of the resection to go proximal to that ulcer.
We'll take the far speaker now.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your presentations. In both the marginal and duodenal ulcer perforations, what kind of follow-up are you doing as far as endoscopically or if at all?
So, yes, you need to follow these patients up with endoscopy. That's the best diagnostic follow-up. So normally you use the maximal therapy and then follow up in 6 months with another endoscopy.
In 6 months?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, please.
Two questions for Dr. Nguyen about GJ complications. Number one, you use ICG to assess the perfusion in that one case. Do you have any advice about the complication rates of linear stapled as opposed to circular stapled as opposed to hand sewn as you might do robotically? That's my first question. My second question is, sorry, I forgot. You can answer the first one, please.
Well, the complication between the different type of anastomotic technique is very well published. Circular has definitely higher risk of surgical site infection. A lot of people has gotten away from circular stapler, including myself. Right now, I perform most of these are linear stapler technique. Complication between linear and hand sewn essentially is the same.
And your decision-making guiding whether to primarily close a perforated marginal ulcer as opposed to redoing the anastomosis?
A perforated marginal ulcer, we don't redo the anastomosis. We actually don't ever do that. We just only close it. I don't think you need to do a major operation in that setting when the patient's sick. I think you should leave that for another day if need be. A lot of time you don't really need to, so we evaluate these patients 6 months down the line to make sure that the ulcer has healed. But if it's chronically, it's still there, we'll come back and revise it. But we don't do a definitive operation at the setting of the perforation.
All the way on the other side.
Question for Dr. Nguyen. For the marginal ulcer, who has a bleeding after the Roux-en-Y bypass, what is the pathophysiology of that ulcer? Is it related to high acid? If it is, then why not to do vagotomy at the same time?
These cases is ischemia until proven otherwise. It could be acid is a contributing factor. There is really no much data with regarding to the use of vagotomy and any other acid-reducing therapy for the treatment of marginal ulceration. Yes, reducing acid does help, but I don't believe that is the culprit of the initial and non-healing ulcer. So therefore, you do have to resect that area because it is ischemic.
The middle of the room.
Me?
Yeah.
Hi, Peter Chang from Austin. Basically this is for anybody. How do you handle the lateral duodenal wall ulcer? Will you take that on laparoscopically? Will you gram patch it? Do you do primary closure? Do they all get drained? Lateral drain, retrograde drain? So what are your approaches to that problem?
I'm not sure what you're referring to in terms of lateral wall as opposed to, you mean you're talking
second,
about?
Second portion of the duodenum.
So you're talking about D2, D3.
Correct.
Okay, so number one, obviously when they occur past the first portion of the duodenum and past the bulb, now you start to raise the specter of hyperacidity ZE syndrome. I think that I would treat these again in the unstable patient, generally patch and go. And I don't think I would treat that surgically any different, but I'd be a little bit more concerned about further investigation of that patient.
Do you drain them?
I do not. I do a lot. My residents call me the washing machine. I like a lot of irrigation. So I don't put a drain because I don't think that's ever been shown to either prevent leaks or treat leaks.
And do you do a laparoscopic?
I do the majority of these open.
Front of the room.
We've had a run of marginally compensated patients with liver disease, cirrhosis, plus or minus portal hypertension. Do you modify your behavior with these patients in terms of dealing with perforated ulcer?
No. They're a no-win. They don't heal well. If they have ascites, you've really got a nightmare to deal with. But I think trying to do definitive operations in a patient with significant liver disease, ascites, portal hypertension, as a way to prevent their patch from leaking just buys you a whole set of different morbidities and mortalities. No, I have no data to support that.
All the way across.
After repairing or patching a peptic ulcer, do you routinely study patients postoperatively, or when can they just be followed clinically and fed early, for example?
Well, in my practice, I generally just follow these clinically. I trained under John Cameron, who was a liberal advocate of studying any anastomosis, any perforation. But I follow the patient clinically, their leukocytosis returns, their bowel function returns, all of their afebrile, their non-toxic. I just treat them clinically and feed them.
Middle of the room.
Hi. Dr. Nguyen, what is the prevalence of alcoholism in these complicated patients, and how do you deal with that?
You know what, we don't know, okay, but the incident is probably around 2-5%, which is pretty high already. So a lot of these patients, when they withdraw from eating, they actually utilize drugs or alcohol as a change in their behavior. So the incident is probably higher than we think. How do we deal with this? These patients need treatment. So once you detect this, these patients has to be treated immediately. So we have very frequent follow-up for our bariatric patients. So patients are seen every 3 months in the first year and then every 6 months thereafter. So at these visits, it's critical to ask these type of questions to make sure that these patients are not using drugs or alcohol, and then get them treatments.
Second question is, you mentioned that a community general surgeon should be able to manage these patients when they come in. But I think the hesitation is not knowing how much of a gastric remnant is going to be okay for that patient. So how would you respond to that?
Your question is how much gastric remnant?
If you have to take down, you know, the Roux-en-Y and redo it,
right?
How much proximal stomach can...
Sure, if you have to take it down. So with regarding to the bleeding, you know, scenario where, you know, you do have to take down the gastro-J, granted, those type of operation, if you're not comfortable as a general surgeon, sure, I think you should look for a bariatric surgeon. But for perforated now, these are emergent operation, I think the general surgeon should be able to take care of that, just like you would any other peptic ulceration. As you can see, the treatment's exactly the same. You find, identify the perforation site and treat it with a Graham's patch. So nothing really changed there.
Thank you.
Don't do a resective procedure for perforation. So in the site of emergency like that, we only treat it by the Graham patch.
Thank you.
Other side of the room.
Cristiano Pender from Florida, from Tampa, Florida, for Dr. Yang. In regards a bleeding marginal ulcer that you have documentation of a gastric fistula, would you resect the gastric remnant? Would you do a remnant gastrectomy?
Yes, I would. That's the reason why you want to know if there's a gastrogastric fistula. Your treatment will be a little different. So just in, besides just resecting the area of the ulcer at the gastro-J genostomy, as kind of shown in the video, I also will do a remnant fundus gastrectomy, essentially.
So would you leave a little stump of antrum behind?
Well, we're just taking out the fundus. That's, by definition, the body and the antrum still there. Only the fundus.
Thank you.
Go to the middle of the room, followed by the front. Middle of the room first.
Mark Zure, Santa Barbara. So one thing that was alluded to in the second talk, the one on bleeding ulcers, that, I mean, wasn't really discussed too much is the role of embolization. That seems to be a newer modality now. A lot of these patients with upper GI bleeds are being admitted to the medical service. We're being made aware because after, you know, the second, third, fourth unit, they're not... There's still a visible vessel. They went in, they scoped, they clipped a vessel, then the hemoglobin continues to go down. They make you aware, and they say, well, we're going to take the patient to angio to get embolized. And it's already now you're at 6 units. You know, the classic teaching is by now you probably should have taken the patient to the operating room. You end up taking the patient to the operating room. 10 units have been gone by. You end up at M&M. Well, why did 10 units go by and the patient was embolized? So I guess in your algorithm, what is the role for embolization? Should everybody be embolized? Assuming the patient is pretty stable, obviously if they're hypotensive and they're not doing well, they need an operation, but should everybody be embolized in this day and age?
I think if you can get it expeditiously, it is probably the appropriate way to go today. There isn't any data. If you're concerned that the bleeding has gotten to a point that you need to do something surgically, I would intervene. But I do think that they do better than we do in terms of complications and mortality.
And it sounds like the treatment is different whether it's a perforated duodenal ulcer or a bleeding duodenal ulcer, where most of the time we're just going to be patching them. For a duodenal, I think from what I'm taking from this talk is ideally they should have a VNP, if not a resection. Is that more or less correct?
So that's the best data out there. We might ask Dr. Pappas if that is his practice, because it's his paper.
You know, we published that paper with great trepidation because it's always nervous to be recommending a bigger operation in the emergent setting. But these patients are unique. They've already come through 2 endoscopies. They might have come through embolization. The rebleeding rates are quite high, and the data suggested that if you add a vagotomy, it helps. You've already done a pyloroplasty almost every time. And so what we recommend to our residents is if the patient is very stable and doing relatively well and not have tons of comorbidity, and you can get the vagotomy done quickly, you should add it.
Thank you.
Front of the room.
Yes. Hello, I'm Dave from India. I'd like to know what would be your line of treatment when you are face to face with flagrant peptic ulcers. as a result of, for example, gastrinoma or Zoringer-Ellison syndrome, what will you do? They will definitely, with such a flagrance, they will still bleed, at least. What will your line of treatment?
He said bleed.
Gastrinoma.
I understood the question.
One more time.
He started on a patient with Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. So yes. They've been diagnosed previously.
Yes.
And not treated.
And his result, he has come with the bleeding. He's come with the bleeding, flagrant peptic ulcerations.
So I think in the emergent situation, the approach is the same in high-dose PPIs. But then it's a workup to determine whether you can do something else about their ZE. In some patients, you can't, but that would be my approach under those circumstances.
Any recommendation regarding vagotomy?
I'm not sure.
Vagotomy.
Vagotomy.
So I think a vagotomy is a completely reasonable thing under those circumstances.
What do you line of treatment?
I disagree. I mean, if you have, I'm struggling here a little bit in that if you have a patient with a known Zollinger-Ellison syndrome who's not had tumor resected, I think you do the least operation and then follow it with a proper operation for Zollinger-Ellison, which is resection of the tumor. So I would, if I had a patient, this is a very unusual situation. I've never seen this in my practice. But if you have a patient with known Zollinger-Ellison, fiddling around with a vagotomy is no more, it's barely a temporizing procedure. So if I had a patient with known ZE and they're bleeding, I would stop the bleeding and not worry with a vagotomy.
So, but a known ZE patient is gonna be on high-dose PPI, right?
Right.
And so then the question is, if they bled on high-dose PPI, isn't the answer total gastrectomy?
Maybe at some point. I would not do that the first okay. bleed.
And certainly not in a high-risk, poor operative candidate.
Tough Thank question. You so much. We're going to stay at the front, and then we'll go to the other side after.
Regarding the vagotomy and pyloroplasty in an unstable patient, what we've often done is just fix the bleeding ulcer and have the thoracic surgeon go in and thoracically get the vagi later. Any thoughts on that?
This is bleeding.
It does put you through two different operations, but I don't think that's wrong in an unstable patient.
Yeah, you can come back later when they're stable. And
I think I'm going to speak for Stan here, but you got to have a patient survive, and if you feel like adding vagotomy at the time will jeopardize your patient's chances, it's far better to worry about coming back later and doing another operation on a patient who's alive.
The other complication I want to ask you about is in the event that your repair of the perforated duodenal ulcer leaks, do you have any advice on how to deal with that? Maybe you've never had that unfortunate experience.
The last one I had was in a patient with cirrhosis, ascites, portal hypertension, thrombocytopenia, I think he was a child C and had a meld about 15, 18, I forget what it was. He re-leaked, we repatched it, drained it, he leaked again, and actually the drain contained it. He went on to die a liver failure death over the next month.
But really just the drain is all you have to live on at that point, right?
Correct. And since he had ascites, I felt little confidence in that working. It actually did control it. He resolved his peritonitis, but I cannot give you a book answer on that.
Okay, thank you.
Go with the other side.
This question is for Dr. Nguyen. Do you routinely use ICG to evaluate the GJ anastomosis for your bypasses? And if so, how often are you finding that it's actually altering your intraoperative management, requiring redoing the anastomosis and so forth?
It doesn't. Normally, these are what we call relative ischemia. It's not ischemic. Eventually, if you wait long enough, it's going to be green. But whenever you see ICG, there's a delay. We call that relative ischemia. It's not ischemic. Ischemia, then we have to resect and redo the entire thing. But what you saw and what I shown there was not ischemia. It's called relative ischemia, so much different. I utilize it to kind of learn about, this issue of marginal ulceration and ischemia. And we kind of learn a lot based on that. So we use it, ICG, perfusion imaging, particularly for revisional operation. I think that's a good area where you want to look at the vascularity. We also use it for our esophagectomy to evaluate the gastric conduit. A lot of the time, the gastric conduit is relative ischemia, so we want to plug in our anastomosis at the site of the most perfusion, and we identify based on ICG imaging.
Thank you. In the front.
I'm Luke. I'm a resident from the University of North Dakota. In my 3 years of residency, I've seen about, I think, 8 cases of marginal ulcer with bariatric surgeons, and they all seem pretty set. 8 out of 8 were all smokers, and I tried putting them on nicotine replacement therapy, and my attendings strongly disagreed with that, the 3 of them that we have that or have had there. Just wondering, do you know of any data showing that nicotine replacement therapy causes increased risk of future marginal ulcers, or is the risk of continuing to smoke once you leave the hospital the bigger issue?
So I don't think there's much data about the use of nicotine. I utilize in my patient.
Okay. Other questions?
I have one question for the panel. For obstruction, is anybody doing vagotomy and gastrojejunum? You know, people used to say that for patients prone to ulcer disease, the gastrojejunum is notorious for marginal ulceration again. So is there an indication, even it's something you can do laparoscopically, vagotomy and gastrojejunum is an operation that's pretty straightforward, but should we be doing it for patients with obstructing duodenal peptic ulcer disease?
I'm not, and in the few situations that I've done that, there have been such prolonged problems with apne that I think you really need to resect a significant portion of the stomach to get it to work again.
I would say my experience is very similar. I think it comes down to sometimes is what are you safe to do? If you are uncomfortable with a difficult duodenal stump or you've never managed difficult duodenal stumps, a vagotomy and posterior large gastrojejunostomy may be satisfactory. And then if that doesn't work, then tertiary referral may be the best choice at that point. But our residents get so little exposure now to complex gastric surgery that I would be... I show up with an obstructing duodenal ulcer and I've got a surgeon in the first or second year of practice, I would ask them, what's your experience with gastric surgery? And I bet it's going to be pretty limited. So I would not ask for a complex operation in that situation.
Other questions? Yes, sir.
This is for Dr. Nguyen, and perhaps is better asked in the thing about a session on emergency general surgery call, a night on call, but I'm Pardon Kenny, I'm from Boston. As a chief of surgery, I have to delineate and credential people. We are an accredited level 1 bariatric center, and as I understand it, the requirements of that, among other things, require a separate call pool of bariatric surgeons who are supposed to be able to handle, and indeed are the only ones supposed to handle these complications. I happen to agree with you that any competent general surgeon ought to be able to handle that type of perforation that you described, but since the patient's going to come back, presumptively, to the place where they got operated on, maybe not, how do you countenance that with the accreditation standards that require that kind of a call pool?
Yeah, I mean, your question is a very good question. But remember, most of these perforated marginal ulcers do not end up in a level 1 accredited center. They end up in a community hospital where there is no bariatric surgeon. So I think, you know, you have to understand that the majority of, you know, these type of patients don't end up in the setting that you kind of described it here. And it should be taken care of by the general surgeon who feels comfortable in doing these type of procedure. But what I'm saying is you should be feel comfortable doing this type of operation. Any more complex procedures, so meaning once you stabilize the patient, did the grand patch, I think you can later refer that patient to a level 1 accredited center for further follow-up of the ulcer, make sure it's actually healed, and then if a definitive operation is need to be done, then it will be taken care of at the level 1 accredited center.
Yeah, the only pushback I make to that, and I don't have any data, but I don't know how many of those level one centers in the United States are indeed community hospitals, end quote, now, with the increasing prevalence of this operation. That said, as you also pointed out, there is a decreasing prevalence of the Roux-en-Y bypass, it seems, and although it's not an operation of the past, it is certainly much less common. So it's hard to know where it's all going to play out.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, I'm going to thank the panel for a very nice job. Thank you very much.